thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Here we go.
Here's John Williams.
This is John. We're live in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We sure appreciate you tuning in. I have a problem with something that happened to me after the Blackhawks game last night. You may have had this problem, too. We'll get to that in just a second. It should not be that way. I want to talk with you a little bit about the Oscars. Everybody is now saying that the Democrats blew it. They had a chance to do something, and they got played. They caved. It's the Schumer, not showdown, it's the Schumer shutdown. It was the Schumer something or another, something that rhymed with sh, and it was a bad thing. And I'm not so sure. You know, when Steve asked me about this yesterday, I said, well, literally, they kicked the can down the road for 17 days. February 8th is, what, 16 days away now. And I've been operating under the presumption that if the Democrats don't yet get the deal they want on immigrants, then they don't have to refund the government. We'll be back where we were. So maybe the Democrats aren't tough enough or smart enough or politically astute enough, but don't they still have the cards? They can do they could shut the government down again. And I don't know that anybody wants that, but if that's the leverage they have, they can still do what they did 2 days ago, and that is say Republicans control the government. This is their problem to fix. We're the problem. They have to fix it. We'll talk about that a little later on. But boy, oh boy, oh boy, are the Dems getting beat up. And Luis Gutierrez is not happy about it either. President is tweeting all sorts of nasty things. You know, really what I want the president to do, and I'd skip that. I just want everybody to be nice. Just be nice. Because too much is at stake. You want the government to be funded and life to go on and us to, I don't know, solve problems, cure cancer. And this doesn't help. And I think everybody wants a resolution to what to do with these children who are here by no fault of their own. It's almost a million of them. So what are we going to do about that? Good Lord, it's time to figure it out. And they got 16 days. So I hope that everybody will play nice.
Well, that's not going to happen.
Play nice for the next 16 days, and then we'll figure this thing out, he said. So the Oscars come out, and I wonder if this is going to be one of those years where people going, ah, there's a problem with the Oscars. They nominate and they award these crazy movies we don't like, we don't see, aren't our cup of tea. I'll tell you what, if Shape of Water wins Best Picture, and maybe it should, but wow, that's a weird movie. That is one weird movie. And
well, remember a few years ago, I was just thinking of this, because The Shape of Water, the actress doesn't speak, or she barely speaks.
Yeah.
And wasn't...
she didn't speak at all.
Well, she did toward the end.
I guess. Yeah, right.
Well, yeah. You did it. But didn't the silent movie with the dog win a few years ago?
Yes, it did. I did. It's the best silent movie I've ever seen. It's not a terrible movie, but exactly. I just wonder if people are going to say, frankly, for my money, Dunkirk is a Dumbkirk. It's a ridiculous movie. I do not want Dunkirk to win either. And on it goes. So we'll see what happens, but I'm just looking at this list, and like I thought a lot of these were really good movies.
So what should be on there that isn't?
Yeah, I don't know.
Big Sick?
Well,
I mean, it was a nice movie.
Yeah, it was.
It was more than a comedy movie. It did a lot of different things.
You know,
wouldn't win.
The big, fat, broad, easy one is The Post. I mean, you know, our favorite stars. It's about something we can relate to. It's easy to understand. The good guys win. That's a movie. They ought to make more movies like that, and not some lady dancing with a fish, for God's sakes. What the hell is that? What the hell is that? These crazy people in California nominating this fish dancing movie. I don't want that. I'm not watching that. We watched that. I walked out after 20 minutes. I said, I'll be in the car. That's what I said. So we'll see what happens. Best movies I saw remain Three Billboards and Get Out. And I don't know that Get Out will win either, because that's not the kind of movie that usually wins either. And we'll see. Went to the Blackhawks game last night. Hung out with some Lou Manfredini sponsors. That's always fun. Boy, there's a grateful bunch. And the nice thing is, when you go to a Blackhawks game and sit in the suite with Lou Manfredini, our Mr. Fixin', a lot of his sponsors, is that everything's to code. If there's a problem with the electrical or the plumbing, it gets fixed right now. Don't have enough seats? Buy the yard. We'll get some in there right away. So it's just wonderful. Then I went over to David Hochberg's suite, and that was pretty sweet. He had some good snacks and sodas, and we watched the game a little bit over there. Violetta was sitting in that suite. That was kind of fun.
Yep, yep.
And then I left the game. Brenda was with me, so we then walked out a little bit early. And how are we going to get over there? Because we Ubered over. And I thought I'd catch a ride with some folks, but we were leaving early. So I said, don't worry, we'll just get a cab. So we went outside the United Center, and there we were, I think, at an intersection with Wood.
Maybe it was Madison.
And Madison.
No, wait. Maybe.
Well, remember when we left you, Violetta? You turned left, and we stayed right there because there's a whole bunch of cabs and Ubers.
Right.
So we come up, so some cars look like they're Ubers or Lyfts, and I said, and they roll down the window, hey, you need a ride? I go, yeah, but I didn't, you know, I'm not your client. They go, where are you going? I go, we got to go up to Wrigleyville. Guy says, great, get in a car, $50. I go, 50? $50. Said, no, we got here for 17. He goes, yeah, it's prime time now. It's $50. I said, yeah, I'm not going to do $50. He says, okay. There's another guy sitting there. And, you know, there were Lyft, Uber, cabs, and then cars that I really wasn't sure about. But I think I was going to get in one of those cars, too.
If it was a reasonable price.
Well, that's the deal. So the guy says, where are you going? I go, Wrigley Field. He goes, $45. I go, no, I want to do it for under 20. He just laughed. He said, I'll make you a deal, 35. I said, would you do 30? I didn't want to do 30. He goes, no way I'm doing 30. Guys were going by, and they would say, where are you going? I go, Wrigley Field. Get in, $40. I said, 17, and they laugh at me.
But I don't understand. Uber drivers don't set their own rate, right?
No, and you know who also doesn't, Steve? Cab drivers. Some of these were yellow taxi cabs. So the guy rolls down the window and says, where are you going? And I'm like, well, that's none of your beeswax. You have to take me to the moon if I want. So I want to get in the car. But he says, where are you going? I says, Wrigley Field. He says, okay, $45. This is a cab. And it didn't dawn on me until a little later on. My wife says, they have a meter. They don't get to quote a price. They don't get to, like, they were making it up as they went. There's a whole bunch of them over there. 45, and I could not get anybody under 30, which is stupid anyway.
Why didn't you use your Uber app?
So we did. So we're standing right there, and Brenda just goes, let's just do Lyft right now, right here. I'm like, well, they all said it's going to be expensive. She said, $18. We had to walk to the other side of Damon, which is just a block and a half, and a guy pulled right up, and we got in. It was $18. But I'm kind of ticked at these cab drivers who, like, where are you going? Ah, here's what I got. That's not how cabs are supposed to work.
Right, but they thought that you're not from the city and you don't know how cabs work.
Totally, totally, because there was a bunch of guys. There was about four or five guys, and they were in town, probably at a convention, because they wanted to go to a hotel downtown. Cab pulls up. He says, where are you going? He says, we're going to the Hilton downtown.
The hottest downtown. Bar downtown.
Yeah. and they go, how much? And the guy goes, $48. And they all go, no! And they just walk away. Listen, I understand how markets work. This is the price. And, you know, we set it. And if we set it too high, you won't get in the cab. If you want to pay that price, you can. That's the fair market. Let it determine its own level. But that's not how it works in taxi cabs.
But you know what they're thinking? Well, if I dupe someone into this, it's like doing three rides in one, so it might take me a little longer to get someone.
Yeah, right.
But when I do, someone's going to bite.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I mean, they're fishing. Because I'm like, hey, you can guarantee you can get $20 right now. $20 right now. I was going to get in that one for 30. And I hate myself now for even thinking that. But that's still not how it's supposed to work.
No.
Cabs, you get in a cab, and then he says, where are you going? And then you say, here. And then it's... what, $3.50 when you get in the cab, and then it starts running. They don't just get to shoot you a number.
Well, you know, since you left early, they probably, there's no one around, but at the end of the game, when the floodgates open and everyone's trying to get a cab,
yeah,
someone was getting in those $45 cabs.
Yeah, I know. Hey, cabs, don't do that, man. You're not supposed to do that. And I suppose if they had taken us home, by the time they got back, they would have missed those $45 rides. But they're still not supposed to be doing that. And then I just love these hucksters, these guys who are sitting there in well-polished Camrys just looking for people. And you can so see the people that are looking for a ride, you know, that are which is great because I was looking for a ride. But $50. So, you know, you're right. You don't have to pay it. But they're supposed to offer it for less. Just a text has just poured in from Lou Manfredini. Had you stayed, I would have given you and your bride a ride home for free. Yeah, thanks, Lou. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Would it really have been free? The emotional toll.
I would have had to listen to smart ways to do a fuse box or something like that. I don't know if
make your car efficient or
winterize. Wow, you guys are kind of cold.
I know.
I mean, I do that too, but he's listening. We know he's listening.
This is Rick. Hey, Rick, you're on WGN Radio. What can we do for you, Rick? Hi.
Yeah, John. The reason I think cab drivers are doing that, they have to compete with Uber and Lyft, because Uber and Lyft, now I'm not a cab driver, I have nothing to do with them, just if I read in the paper, Uber and Lyft don't have to have medallions. So how can these poor cab drivers make a decent buck competing with Uber and Lyft? So I think that's why if they have an opportunity, they're going to do it.
Yeah, that's exactly what they were doing. It's exactly what they were doing. Yeah,
and I got to understand that. And you were right, too, not accepting it, but like you said earlier, some people out of town are that, they will accept it, so the cab drivers are able to make a few bucks that way.
Yeah. Hey, Rick, thanks for the phone call.
You're welcome.
And I have a lot of sympathy for cab drivers. I take cabs more than a lot of folks do, I think, still. Everybody's Uber, Lyft, Uber, Lyft. I'm trying to support those tax-paying, God-fearing, good Americans who are driving cabs around, playing the game fairly, and struggling to compete. But I'm not going to, but you know, just because the Uber's going to rip me off doesn't mean I want the cabs to rip me off. Taxi driver Bob is online too. Bob, you drive a taxi. How are you?
Had to chime in. I've been driving a cab for 37 years and pretty frustrated with the whole industry making a living. What the cab drivers were doing was obviously incorrect. They should be charging you the meter rate.
Yeah.
But at the same time, basically the American public has just told the cab driving industry, we don't care what, you know, regulations you're going through, what background checks you have to go through, what proper insurance you got on your car to take people around. We're going to take Uber because it's the cheapest. I've had a number of friends within the last number of about 3 or 4 or 5 months that have switched over to Uber, and they're driving their fool heads off for 12 hours a day and, you know, making more money than they were driving a taxi, but just driving their fool heads off. And the whole rideshare industry has taken down transportation as a whole. So I can understand why those taxi drivers are trying to do that, because they're making next to nothing. And I just, you know, I'm still in the cab, obviously still driving my own taxi. I'm an owner operator in the suburbs, but it's been brutal, John. And the thing is that I don't know what the deal is, but it seems like in everyday life, Uber and Lyft comes up in a conversation all the time. I mean, for instance, I was watching Channel 7. This Jerry Taft is retiring, so they're having an interview with him. You know, he got a great laugh, blah, blah, blah. He's going to retire down in Florida. And then the conversation gravitates where Jerry is going to sign up for Uber and drive rideshare. I mean, I can't even describe how annoying it is on an everyday basis, hearing on the radio, the TV, people in general, bringing up Uber and Lyft. I just, it's mind-boggling to me.
I can imagine. I get it.
All the time is unbelievable.
I can imagine. And I don't know what the solution is for you. I appreciate the phone call. And, Bob, I appreciate your insight into this. Because that's the direction it's going. I don't know what the solution is. I don't know what the answer is. And if it's any consolation, I talk about Uber and Lyft a lot, but I'm usually ticked at them. Parking in the middle of the street, slowly waiting for their passengers to get in or out or come to the door while traffic backs up. I mean, they make all kinds of mistakes. They don't care. They are trying to make a buck, too. Frankly, a lot of them seem like cab drivers. A lot of them are foreign nationals. You know, they speak with an accent. You get the feeling that they weren't born and raised here. They're conscientious. Their vehicles are clean. They're doing all the things you want. But there's so many of them out there now. The city streets are clogged, and it's hard to get around sometimes. And I don't know what the solution to all this is. I watched this documentary film. It's called Exodus, The Journey Continues. It's a PBS Frontline production. You can watch at 9 o'clock tonight on Channel 11. The director is James, I think it's Blumel or Blumel. James, you're on WGN Radio. How do we pronounce your last name?
Blumel.
Blumel. Well done. What a piece. My goodness. Thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me.
It's the story of Syrian refugees on their way to Europe and what happens when they get there. We've been telling this story and hearing it for over a year now. I mean, this story of the Exodus has been a long-going one. What's new? Why are you telling the story now?
Well, I started 3 years ago telling this story. We made a film for PBS Frontline that we broadcast last year about the first wave. Since then, a lot of the attention that refugees is getting has slipped out of the news. But that doesn't mean to say that the problem has gone away or got any better. If anything, it's got worse.
What do you mean by worse?
Borders are sealed shut now. Refugees are trapped in limbo in countries which they used to travel through in a matter of days. Now they can be trapped there for anywhere between 8 to 18 months sometimes.
We're talking about Syrians principally?
We're talking about Syrians. We're talking about a lot of people from Afghanistan in this second wave. Afghanistan has had rocketing rates of violence, and the Taliban is back with a vengeance, and ISIS have arrived in Afghanistan, and that's caused a lot of people to flee.
So they flee. You tell the story through, at least at the beginning of the movie, the eyes of a single family, that the oldest girl, the daughter, is such a great spirit, such a nice young girl. You want to bring her home with you, but that's the problem. She can't get there, isn't it?
Yeah. I think there's a common mistake that people make about refugees. One is that they're all men from mainly Muslim countries coming to Western countries like an invading force. But that's not necessarily accurate at all. When you go out there and you meet them, you realize it's families with young children who have escaped the bombing in Aleppo. And one of them was this family that we followed, Israha. She's now 12 years old and has made it successfully to Germany.
Yeah, Germany was really the magnet. I mean, you showed the numbers in Europe, and hundreds of thousands of people would be going to countries, which is great. But then there was Germany, 1.2, 1.3 million as the ticker kept going along. Why was Germany so receptive, and what's happened to Germany's attitude about that since?
Germany took a very humane approach. It recognized there was a crisis. It recognized that there was a genuine refugee exodus coming from countries that were unsafe, and Germany opened its doors and said, "Listen, we can handle this. You know, we can handle it." I think Germany expected the rest of the European countries to follow suit. I think they expected a union, that the countries would respond correctly together. What they found was that they were on their own. There were many countries that took hardly any, And of course, this causes an imbalance. You can't have one country in the European continent taking a million while others take none. It's gonna cause problems. It's gonna cause friction.
Well, it doesn't work, but they don't have to take any if they don't want to. I mean, that's this whole nationalist trend that we've been sort of grappling with in the United States and Europe too. And in a way, I see more their case. They've got their own issues, and now they've got millions of people coming in to whom, as I recall, they were giving lodging, education, food, and medicine, right? The generosity surprised even us.
Well, it was a humane response. I mean, it was a fantastic response. They saw an issue. They knew how to respond, and they did it. And I'm sure that history will paint them kindly for that.
Yeah. Yeah, there was the father of one of these kids, and he said history will paint Germany's story in gold. He said, not silver, in gold. Thank you, Germany. And there's the family all sitting around a table learning German. They were just
learning German, adapting, and able to work and contribute.
Well, you know, but then tell me more specifically, if the people were able to contribute and they weren't violent, then why did the country start to cut them off?
Because of this growing tide of nationalism, because what's happening in Europe, there's now something like 24 far right politicians in active governments across the continent. This hasn't happened since it hasn't been like this since the Second World War. It's troubling. It's certainly worrying. And although the numbers might be small at the moment, they are vocal, and they do have a certain amount of power.
Mm. So what do you then tell? I mean, so without giving us every last detail of the story, this family gets to Germany. What happens there?
What happens there is that that they do very well. Their children are educated for the first time in 7 years. Within 1 year, they're speaking fluent German. They are adapting and understanding their new culture and identifying very much with their new culture and planning their future in Germany. And she wants to grow up to be a doctor, and there's nothing stopping that now.
Mm. What about the rest of the refugees? What's happening to the people that are literally living in abandoned railroad cars and things like that?
Yeah, there's for every success story, there's there's far more unsuccessful stories. There's far more bleaker stories. Lots of people that are still living in destitute positions. You know, homeless on the street as in the middle of winter right now.
You know, and as I'm watching this too, and I this will sound boilerplate, but isn't it true? Because, again, these countries really only have a moral obligation. They don't have a legal one, and they don't have a financial obligation to these refugees either. But as these refugees are getting into countries that they can't get out of, suddenly the policy has changed, or it was never going to allow them to advance into a new place, and now they're in refugee camps, and their life is literally frittering away. They're living in these muddy, awful conditions.
Mm-hmm.
If I were them, I would start to get angry, or I would start to get despondent. And that's fertile ground for these terrorist organizations, right?
Well, it plays into their hands. Exactly. I mean, you've spelt it out. It's creating a bigger disaster. Now, if you had responded responsibly and recognized the genuine cases and gave those people asylum, safe passage, there would be only positive, generous thoughts. They would believe, we would have proven that we are the land of human rights, that we do hold humanity highly. As it is, we have shown that to be a hollow truth.
I'm sorry, you're speaking, when you say we, about the United States?
No, sorry, I'm talking as a European.
Yeah, sure. What's the U.S. obligation here, though? They can't walk to the U.S., and obviously we're less interested, at least our administration is, in accepting refugees, or we're certainly going to be more careful about it. And Syria is not on the list of nations that we want to see a lot from. Now, I wonder what your documentary says about the American role in this story.
Well, up until very recently, America took more refugees than any other country. It was an incredibly generous, incredibly brave thing to do. And there's many, many success stories of refugees being given asylum in America and then creating starting a new life and being very successful and adding and to the society. That has stopped. That has finished.
Yeah, I don't know that it's going to change anytime soon either, to be honest with you.
Not under your current administration.
James Blumel is the director of Exodus. The journey continues. You haven't heard the end of this story. Here's a sort of update on where it is through the eyes of a family. You know, I'll say this, when you watch this movie, it's very patient, it's comprehensive, it captures things that you almost wonder, how did the people in this movie get themselves so comfortable or familiar with the cameras that they were living their lives like this? And there's something about the spirit of youth and these families that as unfortunate as a lot of this is, also gave me hope. So well done, James. It's quite a movie.
Oh, thank you. Well, thanks very much. I appreciate that.
And that is on tonight. It's on PBS's Frontline. It'll be at 9 o'clock on Channel 11. It's called Exodus. The Journey Continues. Well done, James. We'll visit again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
You betcha. Okay, stay well.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
There we go. I know what you're doing. You listen to the show going, hey, John, great show. Love everything you're doing, but how come you don't talk more about deer counts?
Lord have mercy.
I'll get you the number of deer killed in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. The number in Illinois last year was 150,000. Dang. Wanted to spend a little time in this half hour visiting with Alex Stone from ABC News. We'll talk to him as he continues to cover the story of the Turpin family in California. Those are those people that had, 13 or 14 kids held in what's described as a house of horrors, some of them shackled to a bed. But they would go on family trips, too. They dressed the girls alike and the boys alike. They were aged from 2 to 29. And I'm reading that one of the reasons they did that was because they wanted to do a John and Kate plus 8 or a Duggars. They wanted to be one of those TV reality families. But can you imagine if the cameras got in there and told us that story in real time? They said they named all the kids with the same first letter. So there was Josh and Jill and Jessa and Joanna and Ginger with a J. And you have to resort to crazy spelling of the names because you've got too many kids. It's time to stop having kids. Ginger with a J. So the kids were emaciated. I was looking at a story online today and they said that one of the things the parents would do was they would get pizzas and pies and stack them on the kitchen counter and not let the kids eat. They said that some of the kids, the ones in the 20s, looked like they were adolescents. They looked like they were 10, 12 years old rather than 19, 20, 29 years old. 29 years old, one of them. It was the 17-year-old who broke free. And the parents were a little amazed. I mean, the mother said, what are we doing wrong here? When you looked at some of the video and pictures inside their house, the family was hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. But he was an engineer with a major American firm. You'd recognize them. I don't know if he was working or still making money, but evidently they had some cash at some point because it looked like some of the interior wasn't completely ramshackle. And somehow or another, they were surviving with a family of 15. And then they go to Las Vegas. How weird must that have been? I'll bet the people that do the Las Vegas wedding chapel where there's the Elvis Presley doing the vows, I'll bet they see a lot of weird stuff because that's weird stuff, right? But they showed up with all of those kids in tow. You'd think they would have said, hey, help. Or maybe their lives have just been so bizarre they didn't even have the mental or emotional tools to save themselves. But there they all were, dressed in their matching clothes in Las Vegas. That story is just strange, strange, strange. Is that Alex on the line? On line 9 is Alex Stone from ABC News. Alex, it's John Williams. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
Hey, John. How you doing? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. I've just been catching our audience up a little bit with this story of the Turpin family. And I know that you've also looked into this a little bit today. Did one of the kids go to college?
Yeah, this is a story now for the last week and a day that we've spent quite a bit of time on and been following day in and day out. And what we know now is we have exclusively gotten one of the child's, the oldest child's, college transcript. And we knew that he had gone to school because prosecutors say that he would go to classes and that Louise Turpin would escort him to school and chaperone him. She would sit outside the classroom, make sure that he didn't go anywhere, and then right when it was done, take him home, and then they would go back into the house. But we know from this transcript, he took a lot of classes. This wasn't like, well, he just went and took you know, a real minor class. He has a GPA of 3.92. He received A's in a whole bunch of different things, algebra, English, guitar, even public speaking. Somewhat surprising that here is somebody who, according to prosecutors, has been kept inside the house, that he and his siblings have been shackled at times, fed very little, but yet he's on the honor roll, he's on the president's list, and he gets an A in public speaking. But he had been taking, it's now clear, quite a few courses at the local community college.
Well, their father was listed as the superintendent and principal of the home school that they were running, right?
Yeah, Sandcastle Day School that they claimed was being used inside the house. Now, prosecutors say that most of the kids inside the house were not receiving any education. And this is where it doesn't really all add up at this point, where so many of the kids, according to the DA, didn't even know what a police officer was, what medication was. They can't read and write, according to prosecutors. But then you have this one student, this one sibling, who was leaving the house to take pretty challenging courses. Why wasn't he coming back with information that that just by being around them that they would absorb? We don't know. And many of those answers still have yet to be answered.
I'm thinking the paper he wrote for that English or public speaking class could have been help. But that's me living a normal life. Who knows what resources, you know. A minute ago I was saying, who knows what tools these kids had to save themselves. But you're right, if he's interacting with society that well, you'd think he would have seen how wrong this is and he might have been able to save them.
Well, yeah, possibly. But we know from past cases of children who were held captive, and again, he's an adult, he's over the age of 18, but that they don't want to disrupt anything. And there have been cases in New York and in Northern California where even when they would go out in public that they wouldn't want to say anything because they were afraid that they would get in trouble or mess something up or nobody would believe them. We don't know what the case is here. We also do now know, multiple sources are telling us, that the family was about to leave for Oklahoma, that they were moving, that they had their items boxed up inside the house, that apparently David Turpin had just gotten a job reassignment. We know he had been working for defense contractors, Northrop Grumman and Lockheed Martin at one time, that he was getting a transfer to Oklahoma. What we don't know is if that played a role in the 17-year-old who had been, again, according to prosecutors, planning the escape for 2 years, if that's what prompted her to jump out that window and decide she was going to do it and run away and call 911 because they were getting ready to move to Oklahoma. Did she think, this is my chance, I've been planning it, I've got to do it, because Oklahoma may be too late? But apparently there was a deadline coming up that they were getting ready to move out of California.
Alex Stone from ABC News on the line. How much do we know about the abuse? Was it sexual or physical or just deprivation?
Well, mainly deprivation, and again, I keep putting this all on prosecutors because a lot of it is what we know from them and that came from police, but it is the starvation, the chains, strangulation, physical abuse in the sense of hitting and that sort of thing, allegedly, that David and Louise Turpin were using. And that it went on for decades. Doctors say just based on the small amount of body fat that these children have on them, just minuscule amounts. One estimate we saw was 0.005% body fat, and the medical needs that they have, that this abuse was going on for some time, that they had not been allowed to eat enough. Now, prosecutors allege that the Turpin family had plenty of money from what he was making. We know at one time he was making $140,000 a year, that they could buy food, and they did buy food, that they had a likeness for apple pie and pumpkin pie, and that they would buy those pies and keep them at a location that the kids couldn't get to them, especially those who were chained up, but they could smell them, they could see them, and that David and Louise Turpin, out of a method of control, would put all that food out there and then eat it all in front of the kids, and the kids couldn't have it. So a lot of it is the physical abuse and the mental abuse. There is one count of lewd acts on a child against David Turpin, but police and prosecutors have not explained that count. They say that they'll do it in court, that as we go into the trial phase, if it goes that far, that we'll have a better understanding of what went on there. So we don't know what that is. We have to assume that there was allegedly some kind of sexual abuse going on there, or molestation, but we don't know what that is, and it's only one count.
Yeah. Have you heard them speak or seen them interact? What are they like, this Louise and David?
Well, yeah, last Thursday we were in court when they made their appearance. They'll be back in court tomorrow, as the DA is now asking that they be barred from having any communication with their kids. Right now, if they wanted to from jail, they could call their kids, they could write their kids. So they're trying to get that cut off. So they'll be back tomorrow. But David and Louise Turpin were sitting maybe, you know, 15 feet in front of me. They spoke very softly. They didn't say a whole lot except just yes when the judge would ask if they understood and the attorneys if they understood what was going on. Mm-hmm. David Turpin looked like he was in a daze, very puffy eyes, wearing a largely oversized suit. They were in street clothes, which is something the judge has okayed in these hearings. She was in a pinstripe outfit that seemed to fit her more. She seemed to be more with it. His hair was all disheveled. He was in this suit that he was just swimming in. But the thing you really notice is he's a big guy. He's got a big belly on him. And here his kids are almost, they were almost killed by the lack of food that they had. And clearly he had been eating plenty.
It's not fair to judge books by their covers, but when you see a family with 14 kids all dressed alike and the dad has some caveman hairdo and they're walking around Las Vegas at the Elvis Chapel, you almost think we need to do an intervention right now, you know, but you can't. You don't, and for all you know, they're the Osmonds. I mean, you just don't know, but good grief, you'd think that the teacher or a relative, they had relatives that had some communication with him, right? Was there nobody out there that thought, hey, we've got to go inside that house and go room to room?
Well, the family members are all on the East Coast or in the Southeast, and they say anytime they would call that the Turpins would say, yep, we're all great. Now the kids can't talk, and they were odd. I mean, it was an odd relationship that they had with friends and family that family members say whenever they tried to come out and see them, the Turpins wouldn't allow them to come over. But they never thought, well, this family is chaining up their kids, that their mind never went there. Neighbors saw weird things, like the kids marching in line all night long through windows until 3 o'clock in the morning. But again, they thought it was punishment of some kind, but they didn't think, well, these kids are being held captive. It was all of these weird feelings, but nobody, at least everybody we've talked to, nobody thinks that they saw anything illegal and that they didn't go to authorities. But there are a lot of folks who say, hey, that they wish somebody would have just said, hey, you know what, guys, you should probably check this out. But over and over again, we hear from neighbors saying they just didn't see anything they thought prompted a call to police.
Alex Stone from ABC News on the story of David and Louise Turpin and their kids. Is it 13 or 14?
13 kids. The counts against them, they've got 73, right around 73 counts against them. But when it comes to torture, it's only 12, not 13, because prosecutors say that it doesn't look like, for whatever reason, that they tortured the 2-year-old. The 2-year-old had as much food as he wanted, could go in wherever in the house he wanted to go, while the other kids were all locked up.
And the dogs, I guess the dogs were well fed.
And the dogs
too.
Were fed plenty well, it appears.
Hmm. Okay, one last thing, I'll just let you go to Alex. But so then what's next on the sort of schedule for these people?
Well, they're being held right now on $12 million bail. Probably not going to meet that. They are still in jail in Riverside. They have this hearing tomorrow about whether or not they can communicate with their kids, which that'll likely be cut off. The judge isn't going to allow them to communicate with their kids at this point. Then they have to be back in court in late February, and that'll be a hearing to say, okay, are we ready for a preliminary hearing? This is probably going to go on for a long time. They're pleading not guilty right now. They could change their plea to not guilty by reason of insanity. Louise Turpin's public defender says that's something they're going to have to look at. They could change it at any time they want to, but as of right now, they're pleading not guilty.
Well, if he's able to work for Northrop Grumman, I mean, you'd think the guy has some mental skills. The kids are in the where are the children then? Where did they go?
They're in hospitals right now. They're still getting treatment. Then CPS, Child Protective Services, will take over. Even the adults, if the adults cannot serve themselves and make decisions for themselves, CPS says that they will work with the state and police and other authorities to take control of them, but they just don't know. They haven't been able to evaluate them just yet. But at this point, the future, at least for the minor children, will be CPS.
Thanks for your time, Alex. I hate to do this, but I'm going to ask you to tell us more of this story down the road.
You got it. Sounds good.
It's your non sequitur of the day.
Hey!
Come on.
Let's play
non sequitur.
No, but I was in a band called that.
It's your non sequitur of the day. Here's the question. Come on, it's time to play. Listen to this line non sequitur from earlier today.
No, but I was in a band called that.
Who was that and what was he talking about? I was in a band called that. Do you listen to WGN Radio much? It pays when you listen. We play a game once in a while called Non Sequitur of the Day. You'll hear something on the radio, and if you can remember it, we'll give you a prize. Today's prize, ooh, hey, is a pair of tickets to Blind Date, playing now through February 25th. This is at the Goodman Theater. It's about two enigmatic leaders, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. Gorbachev. How do you say it, Steve? You're the Russian scholar around here. Mikhail
Gorbachev.
Thank you.
I don't do Russian. I just...
Yeah, but you threw in an extra syllable there for us, I thought.
Just trying.
And their historic meetings to halt the arms race. The fate of the world depends on their chemistry, Reagan and Gorbachev. And that's at the Goodman. I got a couple tickets to that. But you've got to tell me...
Oh, I want to see that.
It sounds kind of intriguing, doesn't
it? So, is 85, that's not Reykjavik. Or was it 88, that's not Reykjavik, is it? Or,
well, I'm not sure.
We were just in Iceland this last year.
Yeah.
I made a point of going to that, the Hofti House where the summit was.
Really?
I have pictures of me on the stairs where Reagan and Gorbachev stood.
I wonder what the equivalent of that would be. Years from now, people will go to the place where President Trump met with Kim Jong-un. Or
maybe the escalator he rode down.
Famous Trump places for 200, Alex. This is the thing he rode down to announce his candidacy. Ding, ding, ding. What is golden escalator? Correct. Select for 400. And then you just work your way through. Famous Trump places for 400, Alex. Ding, ding, ding.
So anyway, that play's only around for like 4 or 5 days, I think, right?
No, I can't go there, Steve. I'm somewhere else now.
Oh, okay.
I'm in Trump land.
Do you know the house I'm talking about, the Hofti House?
Nope.
You would recognize it.
But like, I really...
Remember when Reagan came out and greeted Gorbachev, and Reagan just had a suit coat on, and Gorbachev was all bundled up, and they said Reagan won the summit right then. He looked like the younger guy. None of that makes any... You don't recall that?
No, but I could see... Putin coming out without a shirt on.
Right, same sort of thing.
And Trump having... Right, and they go, wow, look at that guy. So... It's your non sequitur of the day. Here's the question. Come on, it's time to play.
Non sequitur. No, but I was in a band called that.
I was in a band called that. Steve Cochran was talking about what? 312-981-7200. First person to give us the right answer wins the prize. This is WGN. There's that, what is that called? The Hobby House? The Roby House? The what's
Hofti
the name of the,
House.
Hofti House.
H-O-F-D-I.
This
Hofti
is the house where Reagan and Gorbachev
where
met.
Where they nearly eliminated the nuclear weapons in the whole world.
It was a great summit, and so there's the picture of that. Why are we talking about this again?
Because...
Oh, yeah, there's a play at the Goodman Theater.
Oh, yeah, which I don't think is about this summit.
So anyway, we've got tickets to the Goodman Theater, but you need to correctly play the non sequitur of the day game. What were Steve, Bill, and Wendy talking about? Steve said, I was in a band called that. That's one of his throwaway lines. But what was the name of the band? Nobody's got this one right yet. I think I made the non sequitur of the day too difficult.
That was a hard one because I was listening and I don't remember.
Also, yeah, and you were part of that show. We asked producer Elif, Elif, what was the harvest in Illinois for deer was 150,000 or so. What was the deer harvest in Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin?
According to the DNR, John, the total deer number of deer killed were 348,000 in 2016 in Michigan. In Minnesota, the DNR reports, the 2016 total was 173,213. According to the DNR, number of deer killed in Wisconsin was 195,000.
She's falling apart.
195,738 deer, John.
195, 173. In Michigan, 348,000 deer.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, I always do those hunting stories because I just get such a kick out of how the number.
Yeah, we didn't get a kick out of that, said some deer listening to WGN.
Well, the ones who survived and have more to eat did.
Lana Zak joins us now, ABC News, Capitol Hill correspondent. There's one nagging question a lot of us have about what happened yesterday on Capitol
Hill. Just one, Don?
Well, can I give you my nagging question, Lana?
All right, let's hear it.
And thanks for joining us. We so appreciate your expertise in reporting here on WGN Radio the last week or so, particularly since everybody was following so closely this budget crisis, this government shutdown, and the DACA bill. The Democrats are being played today in the media as having caved, having been suckers. They just show that the Democrats are never as strong as the Republicans because they caved. And I thought, well, they still hold the cards, don't they? If on February 8th, the administration isn't ready to sign a bill they like, they'll shut the government down again, right? Have they lost their leverage?
No,
here?
You are exactly right, John. The Democrats still have just as much power to shut down the government, potentially, come February 8th, if there isn't an agreement. And I have to tell you, right now, on Capitol Hill, things are not looking good in terms of the ability of Congress to work with the White House and come up with something that will pass muster in both houses and get the president to sign off on. So, there are a lot of folks that feel like the Democrats blinked, and there's a lot of Republicans right now that are sort of crowing over that, celebrating their win. The White House, of course, claiming this as a win, but this is far from over. The continuing resolution that is on the table right now leaves 16 days for these parties to come up with an agreement. Otherwise, funding again will run out, and we will be in the exact same position that we were in before.
Well, do they literally, like, are the big long conference tables and people are horse trading, going, all right, well, we'll give you this, but you give you that? I mean, is that literally happening today?
No. That happened about 2 weeks ago when we saw that at the White House as the big television production. Since then, it has been a lot of shuttle diplomacy, some moderate senators running back and forth between leadership offices, the president sitting down one-on-one at the White House with Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Those have been the types of conversations that have taken place. But right now, actually, the House is in recess. So the congressmen and women who are supposed to be negotiating this deal, they're not physically here. There's no long table that they are sitting at right now. Members of the House have said that they are hopeful that members of the Senate have said that they're hopeful that when the House is back in session, that they will be having those conversations. But as of right now, we're talking about 16 days. You have to sort of subtract 7 days from that, honestly.
Well, are they going to operate basically with what the Senate had come up with? I presume that's going to be the starting point.
Well, that continuing resolution that the Senate had passed and the House also passed, that's what reopened the government. But if you're talking about the proposal that the Senate had come up with in terms of DACA and immigration reform, that the president had dismissed and had not accepted. And so there isn't currently a working agreement. We also know that, you know, Senator Schumer, when he sat down with President Trump, said, tell me what it would take for us to get an agreement on DACA. And the president said, I need, according to Schumer, this much money for my border wall. And Schumer said, okay, you've got it. But a deal never materialized from that. So there are some questions about what President Trump is willing to accept in terms of an agreement. And we do know that Senator Schumer's office told the White House that since the president didn't accept that compromise proposal, that it is no longer even on the table.
Well, this just doesn't sound that complicated to me, because the Senate had come up with a deal. I mean, if the president had said, okay, let's go, I don't think we'd be having this conversation now. Let's get that thing, put it on the table. Get, I don't know, the Democrat top-ranking Republican there, then get Stephen Miller and put him on a Greyhound bus and get him out of town, and then say, what on this thing needs to be fixed? It would seem to me it would almost be line-itemable. Fix those things.
I think you might be able to get a deal there, John, because that is exactly not what seems to be happening here in Washington. Nobody is actually sitting down saying, we do need to come up with an agreement, so let's figure it out line by line. I'm willing to give you this if you're willing to give me that.
Yeah.
and just figure it out. Instead, there is a lot of political posturing, and there's a lot of he said, she said in terms of what is happening behind the scenes, and all of it has created bad blood between the negotiating parties. And some of what we've heard from the White House has been very confusing to Republican members who don't know now where the president stands on some of these issues.
Right. Well, I don't think Chuck Schumer helped the process with his remarks before the vote. I thought Dick Durbin did. Our senator was very careful to say this is a great opportunity for the Senate. This can be a transcendent moment. The Senate is designed for this sort of a compromise and negotiation. And he also said, remember, you made a deal. Let's bargain in good faith. He was just pouring it on.
And Dick Durbin and Lindsey Graham, his really negotiating buddy and counterpart on the Republican side, those two men have been, when we saw them physically here in the Capitol trying to forge a deal, and those two working very closely hand in hand and working in good faith and trying to get other members on their teams involved. And then we saw, the president and Schumer trying to sit down and less successful in that. And we also know that that McConnell and Schumer have also had conversations. But again, the big wild card in all of this is going to be President Trump and what he's willing to accept.
Well, he wants to crow. Here's his latest tweets. Big win for Republicans as Democrats cave on shutdown. Now I want a big win for everyone. See you at the negotiating table. I abbreviated that because he goes on real long. Then he writes this. This was 9 hours ago. Even crazy Jim Acosta of fake news CNN agrees, quote, Trump world and White House sources dancing in end zone. Trump wins again. Schumer and Dems caved, gambled and lost. The president wrote, thank you for your honesty, Jim.
Yes, and he also has tweeted today, nobody knows for sure that the Republicans and Democrats will be able to reach a deal on DACA by February 8th. So one of the things that you watch for negotiations, when people are negotiating in good faith, they try to hold their fire against the other team, in part because they want to try and come up sincerely with an agreement. And there has been some arguments on the Democrat side that this is not what they're getting. They're not getting a good faith partner out of the White House. And some people pointing to that very negative campaign ad that was launched over the weekend, where the president's campaign ads accused Democrats of being complicit in murder by illegal immigrants in this country.
I'll play that audio on the other side of the break. I'll let you go before then. A couple of our listeners have asked, and I know this isn't why we called you today, Lana, do you have any information or anything to say about the 50,000 missing FBI email and what that will mean down the road? It's not about this story.
Yeah, honestly, another one of my colleagues is really tracking that, and I don't want to be the person to speak out of turn. I know that it is absolutely concerning. The folks in the FBI have to be scrambling to try and figure out how they write this, because it looks terrible for them.
The problem for Dick Durbin, then, and as I'll let you go, just your last comment on this, he not only needs to find a way to get his signature DACA deal done and compromise enough with the Republicans that they'll agree with it without gutting the thing, but he also has to make the president look like the winner. You know, they've got to get this thing done and then let Donald Trump somehow save face. He's got to come out like he's the winner on this. Otherwise, I get the feeling he won't sign it.
Right. Any good negotiation allows people on both sides of the negotiating table to come away with something that they can hold up and go back to their people with as a win. So the question might also be, will the president do the same for Dick Durbin?
We will see. Nice to hear your voice. Thanks for your help today, Lana.
Always my pleasure, John.
Hey, all the phone lines are ringing. I think we're going to get a winner on the non sequitur of the day here on WGN. I'm John Williams. By the way, Barry Brownstone is in our studio. Barry, how are you today?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
You have a shirt that says Sears, Sears Garage Solutions. That's your business, right?
That is correct.
How's business these days?
Very good. We've been very busy in this cold weather.
What do you guys do?
We repair We sell garage door openers and garage doors.
I have had a garage door. See, this is Barry at Sears Garage Solutions that didn't work all of the time. And the chain made squeaky noises, and I thought any day this thing is going to go. You would be the guy I would call to fix that.
That's correct.
I suppose most people, though, just wait until the thing doesn't work, and then they call.
Most people wait until something breaks.
Yeah. And then what happens? So they call you, and then what do you do?
We send a technician out who's certified, background checked, properly trained in a Sears truck and a Sears uniform to make that repair or put a new door in or a new opener in.
What do people usually, can they usually be repaired or could they have to be replaced?
Say almost anything can be fixed, but whether or not it should is another story. Garage door openers have to be brought up to code today.
Yeah. I suppose a lot of people out there have old ones that just aren't that good anyway.
Some of them are really old, 50, 60 years.
And they have to be now where, like, if it's coming down and there's an object in the way, then it has to go back up, stuff like
correct.
That? Correct. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then I call you. How long before you guys get a truck out to my place?
Well, we're usually out same day or next day.
No kidding.
No kidding.
I mean, because really, if your garage door is not working, you're kind of screwed, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
You're like the doctor. I need you to get here right now. So then how do you want people to get a hold of you guys?
All they have to do is go to SearsGarageDoors.com, put their zip code in, and they can make an order online. We have specials online. We're running a $79 tune-up special. They can book it online or call our office.
Sears Garage Solutions.
SearsGarageDoors.com.
SearsGarageDoors.com is the website to go to. One last thing. Some people wonder about some of these big stores we grew up with, Penny's and Sears. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going to happen to Sears down the road. What's going to happen to you guys down the road?
Well, we're part of Sears Home Services, and that's separated from Sears, and I'm nationally known, locally owned, so I am the franchisee, you know, of the business. I'm not going anywhere. Sears still does over 7 million service calls a year. So we're out there.
And you didn't buy into this because you thought it was going to go away. Business gets better every year for you guys.
I've been doing it for 10 years, and every year has gotten better than the year before.
The website to go to is?
SearsGarageDoors.com.
Very nice of you to come in. Thanks for saying hi.
Thank you.
All right. It's 2:53 on WGN. By the way, still no winner on our non-sequitur of the day, eh? So Cochran had a band that he was once upon a time in, and the band was called Matting. And I'm not even going to take the time to explain that. I'll just let you figure it out. John, negotiations in good faith, does that include tattletaling by Dick Durbin? Was that in good faith? I'm not sure what he was tattletaling about, but okay, I'll read your email or your text message. John, the commercial that Trump is running, like the Democrats haven't done that before. They do that all the time. John, it's doubtful. Why would he do anything for Senator Durbin after Durbin went to the press about him and that word that he said in that meeting? Dick Durbin did not. The S word that we all heard the president may have said in that one meeting was released by the Washington Post and by other reporters. And Durbin only came on to talk about that when the president was denying that he said it. That was the only time Durbin spoke about that. Durbin did not leak or break that story. It was out there. The president denied it. And then Durbin said, I'm going to call him on this one. But if the two can't get along, then we'll be back to where we were over the weekend. So, you know, we don't need to pick a winner or loser today, or a good guy or a bad guy. The point of all of this is that if they don't figure it out between now and February 8th, they'll shut the government down again. And I got a feeling that the Democrats will hold their breath longer this time. I don't know how long. I don't know who wins, but I'll bet they'll go longer than 2 or 3 days. It's 2:55. This is WGN. Hey, one more thing before we get ready for Ro and Anna. They'll stroll into our studio in just a minute. I'm on Facebook. Like me there. I'm King John on Facebook. And when you find me there, we're asking you to send us a picture of you. We'll match your picture to an art image in a major museum anywhere in the world. It's really fun to see what our listeners look like. And it's really funny to see how well we can do the match. I'm King John on Facebook. Justin Kaufman's in the studio. Anna DeVlantis is too. Hi, campers.
Hi, John.
Hey. Ready to rock.
Quite the show coming up here, John.
All right, hit me.
All right. First of all, Skilling's back from the Yucatan. We're very happy to finally get to talk to Tom about his trip, about our weather, and also about what's happening in his beloved Alaska today with that earthquake that shook
quite well, that was what, 7.9?
Isn't that crazy? And then the tsunami warning that followed.
Yeah.
That
I guess it wasn't a tsunami, though.
Then
right?
It was later canceled, right?
I know we shouldn't want a tsunami, but I kind of want to see one of those things happen.
Oh,
tsunami
gosh.
Warnings
Don't
are bad
beg
enough.
For it.
I mean, it's just like so fascinating. The water drains away, and then you go, oh, crap, it's going to come back, and then it does with a vengeance.
Yeah.
But that can happen, right?
It can. And I was on those beaches in Thailand 1 year to the day before
oh,
that
really?
Tsunami
before?
Hit for a wedding,
wow.
1 year to the day. And I remember just thinking, what would I have done? And you can't even imagine, right?
Skillful's coming back. What else?
He's coming back. And we are going to talk to A.B. Stoddard and Aaron Kotursky yep. from ABC News because, boy, is there a lot going on in Washington today. We heard the news of Sessions has met with the special counsel, Bob Mueller. Comey, it has come out, also met, but that was last year. We've got, the immigration. Immigration coming.
Yep.
It doesn't seem to be, they're not coming together. It seems like we have a very divisive talk today in Washington on that.
TikTok, kids.
There you go. And we'll preview the debate tonight. We'll also talk a little Chicago baseball. We're getting pretty close, John. Pretty close. Pitchers and catchers in mid-February.
Mid-February.
And we'll talk Richard Roper and the Oscars. It's all coming up.
Have a groovy show.